talks that we want to fit in as many as possible today. However, we have the foresight to see that we may not be able to fit in all of them today. So what we've done is we've taken some time from tomorrow morning from the breakout reporting sessions, which we don't think we need 45 minutes for. And so if people don't get their lightning talks in today, don't worry, we will have that time set aside tomorrow to get in the remaining lightning talks. The other thing we want to do is we're going to run today until 5:45 so that we can fit in as many as possible. But we have to be out of the room at 5:45. There's another group that needs to start setting up in the room at 6 o'clock. So what I want to do now is just do the end of the day housekeeping, and then we'll just run into the lightning talks, and then we'll go. So tonight, the informal social activity will run much the same as last night, except that we're going to be at a place called Fox and Firkin. If you went to American Dream last night, Fox and Firkin is basically one block down. Instead of being on 3rd and Jefferson, which is 3rd is the street that kind of went parallel with the buildings and restaurants, it'll just be closer to the river. So one more street down. The Fox and Firkin's right there, basically the same corner almost. So it's a great establishment, even more beer variety than American Dream. And they won't kick you out at midnight, so you can stay a little longer if you so desire. So, I'm sorry? Question? Anyways, so the shuttle will run the same amount of time, same method to get the shuttle. If you need the phone number, please see me at the end of the day. We'll be out there. So what we're going to do now is we've got a slightly improved, in theory, workflow for the lightning talks. And Roy is going to explain that. But before he does, we have one more. I almost forgot. We have one more very important housekeeping bit. I need everyone to smile.
They're good. Yeah. Fantastic.
You call that smiling?
Okay, go ahead. Okay, we're
going to try to smash as many talks into as small enough time as we can. So the way this is going to work is the list of talks is here only partly to tell you who's talking and about what. What you need to do is those of you who are giving talks need to watch this. And when your time is coming up, you need to get up here because we have two projectors. So we want one projector to be used for the talk at the moment and the other projector to be used for setting up for the next talk. Okay, so we're going to be trying to... Yeah, do not pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. So this is going to have to move quickly. So you're going to have to keep your eye on when you're coming up, and I'll scroll that list. There's 23 items on that list. So they will scroll until we die or until we hit 5:45. And then the rest will happen tomorrow. So just, if you're on that list, keep an eye on it and get up here, get your laptop set up while the person in front of you is giving their spiel at some point. Okay, so let's go.
Okay. Who's keeping time? You keeping time? Okay. Link pearls, something I created because pearls don't work well in browsers. When you want to bookmark a pearl, you sort of have to copy and paste it. And that's a cumbersome, and no user's going to do that, right? So you want to associate the pearl directly with the page. And so I came up with a way to embed in the link element with relationship equals pearl the actual pearl. And then browsers who are aware of this, which is none of them, will be able to use that pearl for bookmarking and display. They could put the bookmark in the address bar, and they can store it. And this is really keen, it's really great, and it could be generalized for other identifiers, you know, depending on how things go. I actually wrote a Firefox plugin that you can go and use, but, you know, I wouldn't use it on the newest version of Firefox because it hasn't been tested at all, and it's sort of pre-alpha, but it sort of demonstrates that it can be done. Now, when I was looking at the JavaScript that is Firefox, it's a tremendous mess. And making a general way for this to work in Firefox is going to be a cumbersome task. And it was going to require significant changes, I thought, to the underlying Mozilla code, which is in C++, to make it general for other identifier schemes. I think it's a really good thing. There are a lot of people who have expressed interest in really making this real so that Firefox as a plugin or by default could use these things. And honestly, that's about all there is. I wrote up this RFC-ish document that you can get off the from the Perl server, perl.org. Any quick questions in 20 seconds?
How do you need such fundamental change to get to work? I mean,
just because of how the JavaScript in Firefox is written. I had to, instead of adding things on, I had to sort of replace a function or a couple functions within the Firefox code.
When you click on a Perl, it forgets that it's a Perl. It just does a redirect.
Some okay, any questions?
I know you're from OCLC, so you're pushing Perl, but what if somebody else is using like a handle or something else?
Yeah, the link with relation equals handle would work just as well, but you'd have to generalize the code and write plugins to make it actually work with handles. And, you know, it's just a matter of sort of extending it, the basic framework that would have to be put in the Mozilla code.
All right, I'm going to talk about XISBN real quick. It's a service that Tom Hickey created, scanned WorldCat, poured out all the ISBNs, ran them through some algorithms to come up with FerberWorks, and now he's got a web service. So you find, you got your ISBN, you construct a URL, and you can see the URL there, the example. You just plug in whatever your ISBN is and invoke that URL, and you should get this back. It's just a list of all the other ISBNs. And this will come back as an XML document, so you can do whatever you want to with it, you know, in an XML fashion. So it's a useful service. Other people have been integrating this into their systems. And I have an example that I'm going to show where I use this. And it's based on something that John Udell did at, I think he's at InfoWorld. And he had a way where you go to Amazon or Barnes & Noble or wherever, you find a book you want, and you want to know if your local library has it. He creates a bookmarklet, and you drag this bookmarklet up to your browser, find your book, click the bookmarklet, and it'll scrape the ISBN off that page and take you to a deep link in your local library, which is really cool. I mean, it's just amazing that it's so simple to do that. The problem is, if you're looking at the paperback on Amazon, that ISBN is different than the hardback ISBN that your library has. So you go click on this link and it's not there. So using this service, I kind of combine those two ideas. And so I'm gonna install, show you how to install here. This is our ResearchWorks page. Find my thing here.
Bookmarklets.
And I've set these up. I have to set this up on a library by library basis, and I do this on a, you know, just as people request them. I've got several dozen here. So I'll find Columbus Public. Mills, I don't know. It's in here somewhere. Columbus Public. I drag it up to my links bar. Drop it in there. I'll go to Amazon or Barnes & Noble or wherever, find a book. There's a book I want. I click on my bookmarklet, and I scrape the ISBN, called Tom's service, got all the other ISBNs, and it did a search, and I apologize. My fancy tablet's kind of messed up here. I can only show part of the screen. But it did a deep link into my local library. And these things come back in sorted order. So the very first item on the list that comes back is the ISBN that I asked for, just in case I really do know what I want. But beyond that point, the other ISBNs come back in holdings order. So the second item on the list is the second or third most held item, depending on whether I chose wisely or not in the first place. So in my case, my local library can only show one, I can only do a single ISBN search at a time. Some libraries you can search several ISBNs, and in my case I can't. So I show a list here on the left-hand side what the other ISBNs are. If my library doesn't have that first one there, then I can go go through the list and try the other ones one by one, you know, until I find one that I want. And like I said, I can do this for pretty much any local library. There's a few of them that give me headaches, but if anybody wants one set up for their local libraries, let me know. And there's a place on the page to do that. So I'm done. Any questions?
Did you see the ISBNs come back and get an order of how much their holdings in the LCLC?
Right, exactly. The first one is, I put the first one first because, actually Tom Service does that, just because I might actually know that I want a specific one.
Okay.
But it's holdings beyond that.
I didn't realize that about the ISBN.
Right. Any other questions? All right, thanks.
So I see the title of this little lightning talk has been censored a little bit. My initial title had been censored twice over. It had initially been vendors give us our data, and so
it's number 9. You're gonna give us again in 3 minutes.
That's awesome. Okay, so that's why. Okay. So what is this about? Well, we want access, many of us want access to our subscription indices or databases, and directly or some equivalent. So, I mean, why do we want this? Well, basically the themes here are we want to do things that the vendor didn't necessarily anticipate. So this goes beyond even them providing us services. And the purpose of that is to improve the user experience, the patron experience, or the typical kind of theme. And what does that mean? Some specific examples, well, citation metrics, impact factors, reviews, ratings, rights and availability, that sort of thing. And you can go on and on with the different things you can do when you have access to all the data and metadata. And a lot of that's bulk data, not just metadata for individual records. And there's more access to log and usage data, but and there's also value-added services you can do. If you take disparate databases and bring them together, you know, you can unify them, you can get deduping and other sorts of value adds. And there's even stuff like caching to improve speed and access issues. And finally, you know, I hate to say it, but to avoid clunky, you know, metasearch interfaces and idiomatic vendor interfaces for the individual services. So what does this require? And I'm not even really the expert about the relationships with vendors, but just, you know, from a naive point of view, I think it requires some recasting of the relationship between vendors and us. We don't really necessarily need vendors to be providing individual services anymore. We're kind of getting beyond getting our data through this straw of these services. So what does that recasting kind of imply? Well, we're switching the roles around, so it's more we're paying for access to data. This would be more optimal, I think. So we pay for access, and we can even go get the data ourselves. We've learned how to do this with things like OAI. So we don't really need the service provision anymore. We just need access to the data. And I think, in general, we'd be happy to pay for it to support these efforts, you know, these publishing efforts and so forth. And in a sense, we kind of need this, right? Because Google's doing it anyway. They've got Google's in all this data. They've got the clout. They've got the money and so forth. But they're not doing it the library way. They don't care as much about deep, rich metadata. They're more making it look like web search and behave like web search. And I think we want to do different things, you know, that go a little bit deeper and treat the patrons as kind of a community that's closer to us. So, you know, the conclusion is, well, why don't we try to do something about this? Why don't we? And anybody who agrees, right, that they want access to these vendor subscription databases, we should get together and talk about kind of prodding vendors to get some of this data. And this connects a little bit to the talk I'm going to give tomorrow. Basically, we want to pull this kind of data in for a search system, and this connects to Colleen's talk that she already gave, and to some of the other things people are doing. But That's about it. Questions, comments? Everybody agree?
So if we wanted to do something, what's the next, contact you or
what's the next? Sure. I mean, you can contact me. It'd be good to see who else is interested in doing things. You're CDL, right? So yeah, you know about the stuff Colleen's doing. Yeah, we should definitely talk. I personally have no clout or anything, but maybe if a bunch of us get together and are very visibly asking for them, you know, maybe even signing this statement or something, if anybody has connections with vendors and so forth.
Our whole collection is based on that model. I mean, all of our content is hosted locally. So, I mean,
how are you doing that?
Well, right, but you have like security issues, right? That
well, but your users are providing, well, not all the data. No, you.
I mean, all of our scientific journals online, full print, full text stuff, we all post locally, so.
Okay. Well, how are you? I mean, is this the same stuff that, say, we as a typical university are subscribing to and not hosting locally?
Yeah, I mean, it's Thomson, the Elsevier content. I mean, it's on all the scientific journals that we deal with, yeah.
But you guys are kind of special. I have to go now.
Okay, I'm going to quickly talk about how to securely keep track of borrowers' circulation history. Obviously, your checkout history is something that would be tremendously useful for some of the features we want to offer. You know, if you like this book, well, this person liked these other books, too. So suggestion services. Targeting our collections and our budgets to what people are really interested in and kind of conceptually linking them together. The problem, of course, is that it's tremendously revealing. It's a huge amount of personal data to give out, and the way that it works is that if we keep that data, we all kind of operate under the assumption that someday we're going to get asked for it. So I kind of started to think about some ways that we can keep that data but sanitize it or protect it in some way. This isn't a new problem in the field of epidemiology or various surveys where you're tracking illnesses or something like that. You need to keep people's data relatively private. And what they do in that world is they generalize the data so that each data point can match a certain number of people. For instance, if we had all the people in this room and we just went by the first names. Well, some people here have unique first names, so that would still be a unique identifier. Other people, I don't know how many Johns we have here. Just chopping off the last name and keeping the first name would give them a degree of anonymity. But that method of kind of sanitizing things in a demographic sort of way might not necessarily be the best for us, because if you're trying to target suggestions for somebody, the demographic information about them, a male age 25 to 30 living in zip code 98119, are the other people in my neighborhood going to be interested in the same things as me? Well, maybe, but it's probably more useful to find people in the system who are close to me and as far as what books they check out, rather than grouping via demographically. And then the other problem is if you have small data sets, it's kind of hard to sanitize that data. Obviously, there's a lot of work that's been done along those lines, if you're interested. So the alternative I came up with is, I left out the mathematical formulas and stuff, but basically you've got some data here. We've got a list of borrower keys, and you've got what they checked out, and you've got when they checked it out. If you have a two-step process here, you can get it so it's anonymous and it's still persistent. If I check out a book 2 years ago and then I check out a book today, within the data they'll still be linked together, even though we don't know that those two data points correspond to me. So the way that it works is that, at my library, we encrypt the borrower keys in the circulation history with a secret key. So right here, we can no longer trace this back to borrower number 123. If you're looking at this data here. On the other hand, if the Attorney General comes and knocks on the door and they ask for what your secret key is and your list of borrower keys, then they can they could brute force it really easily and figure out what it, who was who. But on the other hand, okay, so if I've encrypted this data and then I send it off to a library, preferably in a country with no extradition treaties, I hear Venezuela's nice, and then they encrypt my encrypted data with a second key, so it's doubly encrypted, and then they send the data back to me. Well, if you get the data that I have is basically sanitized. By looking at that, there's no way to trace it back to the original patron, the original borrower numbers, without having both of those encryption keys. So your offsite encryptor keeps you kind of safe there. Yeah. Is there anything more I was going to say? Yeah. So over time, the borrower number is going to keep getting traced to the same thing over time. 5 years later, it'll still, borrower 123 will still get corresponded to this. So you can still make useful inferences out of this sanitized data as far as, what people like over time without keeping any history of what they checked out in the past, basically. So that's all. Any questions?
Can I borrow your laptop?
Sure.
You have a browser on here?
Yeah.
Show this application, a little web application I did real quick. We had an NJIT research day coming up. We were trying to expose the research that our faculty and our graduate students were doing. So I wrote a little application which basically was going to one of our databases that we subscribe to, Scopus, and what it was doing was pulling, running a search against it and pulling the articles written by NJIT faculty and students, whoever they might be, and added to the database in the last 7 days. That's just a canned search you can throw against their database. And it was pulling back that information, and I was basically repackaging it and sticking it up on our website up here. Each of these links was then a link that was going back through our easy proxy. Well, I didn't mean to click on that. I'm just trying to show you. How do we go back?
Don't go.
All right. And so that was going back through our easy proxy server and putting the person right at that article in the database. I branded it with the database name there. I also added some links to set up your own alert. So you could get an email of that if you wanted. And I also added something else, get results from the last 30, 90, or 365 days worth. Again, those all launch the user back into the Scopus database. So what I was trying to do now, I took the vendor on this. I said, look, this is against our contract. I'm caching 5 results worth of data, which clearly I can't be doing. Automatically, I've got a job that ran it every night. Clearly, our contract forbids that, and I'm exposing your data to the web, and clearly our contract does that. But this is pretty cool, don't you think so? Isn't it a win-win for everybody? and they agreed. They said, yeah, it is a win-win, because what they're trading off in here is exposure, allowing us to expose a little bit of their data in exchange for promoting the database, using it in a way that's going to drive usage, it's going to work for our faculty, and so forth. So we amended our contract, and they allowed us to do that. At the time I first did it, I was doing it in a screen scrape way, because that's what they had available. Since NJIT is a development partner with Scopus, since I've got access to their API, which I don't actually know if it's a public API or not, and I'm trying to rewrite the code. But I guess to end my talk, I don't know what time, I got time, but to end it, I'm trying to suggest that there could be a paradigm shift for our vendors, and that in exchange for opening up a little bit more with some APIs and allowing us to kind of expose their data in a limited way outside their interface, it's really going to drive more usage to the database. It's going to expose their data in places that where our users are, where our faculty are. The next step what I was going to do was try to design a little RSS feed that would allow, say, the chair of the physics department to be able to expose the most recent articles by his physics faculty on the physics department homepage. And again, that would just be a simple little automated thing that would go. The only other, and there's a lot more different searches you can run. And that's, you know, I did new papers written by NJIT authors. I also did one that's on top cited papers by NJIT authors. This one I grabbed 20. This article, the first one, was an NJIT author. It was cited 1,321 times. Next one was cited 107 times. Next one, 92 times. Again, this is publicizing our faculty's research. And again, I'm trying to convince the vendors that this is something good to do. There's many other searches that you could do. You could have top-cited papers in a research area, physics or nanotechnology, new papers that are citing NJIT authors, and et cetera, et cetera. So a little web app I did, I'm hoping that there might be, this might be something that could be more widely used in other libraries. Questions?
Scopus gave our library, I asked them about their, if they had the API or not. This is probably maybe 5-6 months ago.
Yes.
And they said, no, we don't have an API that you can use. Has this been since 6 months?
This was, I was told yes at the end, in the beginning of December. And I, just before I came to the conference, picked up on that conversation again. So they have one. I have not been able to do any coding on it yet. I don't know if it's public or not. That's the thing. We're a development partner, so it may be that it's only available to us.
So Casey's already used your laptop?
You use it for
web browsing, that's it. All right, thanks. I guess I'm sort of putting you on the spot. Classics, the way it works, the first few hundred numbers in the DGs are sort of ancient Roman history, but then the rest of the DGs I'm not interested in. I may also be interested in the PAs, which is where classical literature is. I may be interested in the archaeology section, all these different things. Library of Congress call numbers don't really allow me to bring those together in any easy way. So what I ended up doing is I wrote a script in Perl that parses Library of Congress call numbers and assigns them to a broad subject area. And that's just what I want to show you. The problem here is you have to figure out how to map that ontology that they're using for Library of Congress call numbers to whatever local ontology or whatever you want to call it is useful for you. This is my institution's homepage. You can see that we've got sort of a general list of subject areas here over here on the left. So any item that we have has to fall into one of these categories. And of course, there's subcategories within those. So within humanities and social sciences, there's English literature, there's all the different things. I work at a university, so it's based on departments and faculties, that kind of thing. So I looked at this division of subjects at my university, and I wrote a Perl script that would take Library of Congress call numbers. I'm just going to shamelessly show you my resume, because that's where the script is. Actually unintentional, but so it takes Library of Congress call numbers, it matches them against that sort of hierarchy that I showed you, that two-level hierarchy of departments at my university. It's really straightforward and simple. And the only reason I'm showing it to you, well, take a look here. It has regular expressions that it uses to figure out where the call number, what subject the call number belongs to, and just assigns a variable to that particular item. So if you think that this is useful, write down the URL and steal it from me. I don't care. If you have something that does this in a different way, I'd be very interested to hear about it, because this probably sucks because I'm not a Perl coder. So get in touch with me. Colleen mentioned a few things. But yeah, let me know if there's cooler ways of doing this. Let's grab my hand. Thanks.
I'd talk a little bit about the OCLC research software license. We put out a fair amount of open source software, and we started out with a license that was done entirely in-house. Then we decided that we'd try to get it vetted by the OSI, because just so that people really believe that it was an open source license. To tell you the truth, putting it through the OSI process didn't really help the license very much. It did make people believe it's open source, but the license that we got out, I think the only reason we got it through is because everybody said, okay, this is enough, we'll take it the way it is. But I'm afraid we ended up with our license fairly confusing. It was specific to us so that everybody has to read a new license, which is always a pain. It was listed on the OSI page, which was good, but everybody that used it seriously had questions, to the point where things like DSpace, that was using the OIICAD, Jeff's software, were pretty much ready to pull it out of their software. So, we thought about why we're doing open source and what the license is for. I mean, we want to protect OCLC, but the reason we're doing this open source is to get people to use it. So I think you want an understandable license if you're going to do that. So the questions in our mind was, what kind of restrictions do we want on what people can do? And always important, what can we get through our lawyers? So. And from my mind, I don't really have a religious view on this that a lot of people do, but we just wanted it to be used. So something that had as few restrictions that our lawyers could live with is what I tried for. And we decided on the Apache 2.0 license, and I wrote up a little thing. We circulated around OR research and see what people thought about it. We pretty much agreed on it. I sent it over to the lawyer and said, this is what we'd like to do. And about 3 days later, he said, okay. which was a surprise to me. I said, where's the argument? What's where? So I didn't say that. I didn't say anything. I said, okay. So that's what we're switching to, the Apache. Some of the software we've out there is still under the old license. If you're using that and you need it in a new license, we're glad to consider that. And pretty much, I don't think there's any reason why we wouldn't switch over to the Apache license. So these are some of the other things they looked at. But I think Apache's pretty good. This book here is a good book. You know, it doesn't cover everything, but it has a fairly in-depth discussion of the different open source licenses. It's an O'Reilly book. I think that something like the GNU tries to force people on how they use things. I think the reason open source works is because it works. It's a good idea. It isn't something you have to put additional restrictions on your code. And if you're interested in working at a place that does open source software, you might consider OCLC Research. When I left a few days ago, we had an open position. But that's what we did for Apache. Thank you. Any questions? Do I have time? We've got another minute. No questions.
Can you explain what the relationship between the Apache license and the software like ESP? I'm not sure.
Yeah, the Apache license has some stuff about has more stuff about patents. BSD is really bare bones. I think BSD has a couple things that MIT license. MIT license hardly says anything except don't sue us. BSD says something more. Apache covers more of the things people worry about, patents and that you can't use the software, they're suing us, which is actually a problem with the GNU software license where we'll let you use it even though you're suing them. They claim that that's incompatibilities, but I don't know, these seem a little bit academic to me. Thank you.
Okay, this isn't good. Come on. Okay. Is that the right one?
No.
Okay.
All right, Aaron, if you don't need a projector, maybe you can
try the other one? Okay. Come on. No. Oh. Okay, this is going to be a tough one without a visual.
Okay, well maybe, Aaron, can you... You need
it.
Oh, you didn't. You don't need. Okay. Karen.
Let's see if I can find it work.
Sorry. I'm going to try.
Here. You keep doing that.
Or you think that it's more technology?
Yeah.
Oh, see.
Yeah. Of course. Yeah.
Okay,
so I'm going to change the
other
displays.
Okay. Why don't I go while Art tries to figure out what he's doing? Okay. What I'm going to talk about is at University of Houston Libraries, we've implemented weblogs, and we're using movable type to do this. But we implemented movable type, and we found out, well, it doesn't exactly do all the things we want it to. One of the biggest things is we want all of our weblogs to look the same. We don't want anybody to be able to change the template for them. We also needed more granular permissions than what comes with movable type. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to show you what movable type looks like out of the box and what you get in terms of permissions, and I'm going to show you what we built on top of it. So movable type out of the box, you get lots of different authors, and you can assign permissions to authors for various weblogs. So if I go in and I look at the permissions that are assigned to a particular person for a particular weblog, you have lots of different things. You have, they can be a blog administrator, which basically means they can do anything. They can create an entry. They can upload a file. They can edit all entries. They can manage templates. They configure weblogs, so on and so forth. Basically, the three things that are checked here are the only things we want people to be able to do, because otherwise they can mess up how the weblogs look. So what we decided to do was build on top of movable type using Cold Fusion and update the MySQL database so it gets particular permissions. Depending on who you are, you get particular permission, a particular permission mask. So everybody gets these checkbox permissions. The other big thing for us was we wanted people to be able to, how many people are familiar with WordPress? Quick show of hands. You can create pages in WordPress, movable type, no way to create pages unless you let people edit templates, which basically means they can mess up whatever the whole weblog looks like. So we wrote this little interface that says add page, edit page, remove page, where they can add pages to movable type, just like you would be in WordPress, without messing up what everything looks like. So if I pop one of these open, I get a WYSIWYG tool, and I can edit this page, and this page will come up in the template. We also gave people the ability to control the authors on their weblogs. Right now, it's set up so everybody gets co-authorship, but eventually be set up where there's co-authors, reviewers, and posters. Co-authors mean can do anything. They can do the same thing as the owner. Reviewers can review things, but they can't mess up your category scheme. And posters can just put new things in, but they can't change anybody else's posts. So what's really great about this is that this all works really well. Like, the stuff in movable type that works, we can use, and the stuff that doesn't work in movable type, we've been able to build on top of using Cold Fusion. And all of our pages are dynamic, and they all look the same. And the other big thing we did was we have some blogs that are internal on our intranet and some blogs that are external. So in the create blog form, it has a checkbox that says internal access only. And if you check this box, it gets set up differently so that only people internally can access it. So all of this has allowed us to use movable type to basically manage a whole bunch of weblogs for our site. Any questions? I have like a few minutes.
If you wanted to work like WordPress, why did you go with movable type and not WordPress?
Because the multi-user version of WordPress at the time was still in beta, and I was skeptical, and my boss was very skeptical about using something in beta. And it may be a year from now we export everything and throw it into WordPress. And for... And so a year from now we may export it all when it is supported and throw movable type away. Because for U of H, an education license to run this was $600. And $600 for U of H is nothing. So...
We designed the header logo because that's freaking awesome.
I'm showing you the test server, which isn't behaving very well today. So, any other?
That's
cool.
It.
Sorry.
Okay, Google Maps. I love maps, and maps are the most wonderful invention for directionally challenged people. And I wanted to start with this one. This is considered the oldest map in the world, if you consider maps to be drawings of physical places. This one's between 3 and 4,000 years old, probably created for someone like me. So when Google Maps appeared, I was really interested in how do you use this tool to put your own stuff in, because the interface was so neat. And there's quite a number of resources out there. There's a book called Google Map Hacks, and there's a whole raft of different tricks you can use with Google Maps, and I'm sure many people know about it. This was the one that I was quite interested in, and it had to do with, yeah, I don't know what's going on there, so I'm not going to worry about it. It had to do with how Google uses the tiles. When you see a map, you're seeing a whole bunch of different images, and basically there's this equation that takes latitude and longitude, runs it through a formula, and breaks it up into sort of this here graph format that takes into account the curvature of the Earth. What all that means is there's a bunch of tools out there where you can put an image in, run it, create your own tiles, and then tell Google Maps to use that. So, for example, the last Access conference was held in Edmonton. So I'm able to add my own thing here, and this was all the bloggers that were in Edmonton at the time. And you're able to control the tile, so if you want to reveal anything about the blogger, you can zoom out. So now you know. But anyway, because it's an Emmy, and it's a bunch of tiles, I discovered there's an XML format for graphics called SVG, and SVG lets you set sort of a viewport. The problem with cutting up tiles is if you get into a lot of zoom levels, you end up literally creating thousands and thousands of files you have to serve out. With SVG, you can set a viewport, and you can work from one image file and just change the viewport. So I have an example here. I was interested in isomorphic metric maps, which are 3D maps. So I was playing around with the idea of doing one for the library. And this was just done in SVG, and it's not very good. But the idea is, this is all one image file, and it has Google Maps thing here. So my question I'm going to leave you with is what to do with robot monkeys. But basically, Google Maps lets you put your own content in and then use that interface to manipulate that content. And SVG is a way to do that really easily. So, oh, I get 2 minutes. Okay. Any questions? Great.
So can you tie that in with, if you know where your shop location is?
Yeah, that was the idea, actually, that you could create an SVG file. You could use a style sheet just to change whatever change for your shelf description, and then you can feed that into Google Maps and use that interface.
You've done that with shelf locations before.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, but not with the Google Maps interface. That's the part I like, that it's got a really nifty interface to feed all this stuff into. Thanks.
So Jim Robertson, I guess, yesterday asked me to say a little bit more about coins. So I figured I'd show you the coins generator. All right, so this is just a view of Google Scholar. And we've added open URL links into this Google Scholar view with the open URL referrer extension. So if I take this, click the open URL, it's sent to the coins generator, which is at generator.ocoins.info. And that's actually running on an instance of our OpenURL resolver that's been customized to generate coins. So I've sent this OpenURL, just had a PubMed ID and a title in it. And the resolver has gone to PubMed, fetched the metadata, displayed all the components of the OpenURL, all the metadata, and here is the coins, which is just a HTML span tag with an OpenURL context object stuck in there. And now you can cut and paste that and stick it in any HTML page, and coins-aware software or processors can then read that and do all sorts of cool things, like, well, put in OpenURL to your OpenURL resolver, or it can do any other sort of cool thing that you can think of doing. So that's it. I have 3 minutes. If anyone has any questions on the coins generator or anything related to the topic.
Don't you have a form-based input for that too?
Yeah, there's a form-based input for this too.
How much did he pay you, Ross?
All right, so if you just go to generator.ocoins.info, you can type in the citation data, and it'll also do, thanks to the CrossRef people, you can paste in a DOI. It'll go and fetch the metadata for the DOI and put in a full-fledged coins. You can do it for all of the OpenURL 1.0 metadata sets. You can do books. You can do patents, dissertations. And if you want to put Dublin Core metadata in there, you can do that too and use the Dublin Core version. So that's it. Yeah.
Do you have a good example of a site that uses coins?
We have a couple of sites listed on the coins, ocoins.info site. There's the spec at ocoins.info, and there are a bunch of sites that are we've talked to that are intending to implement coins at their next software revision or whatever. But there are a couple blogs. We have some. On the books page in Wikipedia, we have ISBN coins. There's an internet free internet journal that uses coins in their citations. And as I mentioned yesterday, Open WorldCat will have coins in March.
Structured blogging techniques.
Great. 43 seconds. Whoever's next should come up.
Who's next?
Who's doing automatic metadata extraction in the digital library? There's nothing.
Question mark in the series.
Okay, is it done?
not do down? Searching for signal. My mouse won't work. Good. It's better to start at the beginning, I think. Okay. My little lightning talk is about standardized image production and metadata storage for libraries and archives. It's a mouthful, or what we refer to as content for lib. And as of yesterday, Robbie used that term, so I guess I have to give that over to him and do that. My name is John Cernowski, and I was the former director of imaging products for Northern Micah Graphics. It's an imaging service bureau, and spent a lot of time converting materials for learned societies like ACS and AIP, and a lot of the libraries and research libraries in the country. And what we did 2 years ago is we started a project to help hopefully standardize some of the imaging that's being done by libraries. So we founded Res Carta Foundation. It's to encourage the creation of community standards and open source tools for digital collections. We are a not-for-profit foundation, and we've got that through the IRS. And we're currently being sustained by a grant from the Gillette family. That's called a one-horse pony, and we're hoping to expand that. Now, I don't know, a lot of what you've been dealing with in the last day and a half, 2 days, has been dealing with your OPACs and your holdings. But libraries are doing a lot of imaging lately. And what started out in our experience with libraries started back in 1995. With the first major imaging job that we did for libraries. We've been doing library work before that, but this was the major project, 3.5 million objects created in 1995. After that, Ann Kenny and the folks who ran the first project got another grant, and we're talking about Making America 2. And what they wanted to do was take what they had learned from MOA 1. They said, we have to create community standards for the creation and use of digital library materials, and a national software architecture allows digital materials to be shared. That was 1998. And they said, without community standards, each library will store electronic content in a proprietary format and proprietary computer systems. If we go to the bottom, in short, we'll have created a series of proprietary collections and missed the opportunity to create this. This was 1998. Today, libraries and archives are creating digital objects at a geometric rate. I mean, 2 years ago, you get a library that say we want to do 100 books or 500 books. Now we're getting requests to do all the newspapers for South Dakota, all the newspapers for Virginia. Famous guy Ross Singer was talking on special collections. And Ross, I don't know what you were doing on the Christmas Eve, but he said the same thing in 2005. So what we're saying from Making America in 1995 to NDMP in 2005, a 10-year span, every major project has had a new, exciting, only invented here, file naming convention and metadata format. These are two that are going on right now. Khalifa's got projects with us in NDMP. Both of those, if you take a look at those and try to parse those, you know what we're dealing with. We feel it's going to take mountains of code to parse this in the future. We know this stuff's going to have to be reformatted out of these existing data silos, and someday that's going to have to be done. So we've taken a guerrilla approach to standards because we can't get anyone really to listen to us. So what we've done is created an open source tools for creating digital objects. We're using archive quality data. We're giving suggestions to small libraries and small institutions of how to do this so that they get good archive quality without overdoing it. We're leveraging existing off-the-shelf products.